Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the sixth in a series of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George P. Shultz. Originally recorded in 2006, Shultz speaks with former State Department legal advisor and Reagan administration colleague Abraham D. Sofier about dealing with international terrorism during their time with government. We hope you enjoy this week's episode, and be sure to stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
George, it's a pleasure to speak with you today. I just wanted to remind you to start with of how we met. I heard through your deputy secretary that you were interested in having a lawyer come and work for you. And it was a surprise for me. I was sitting on the bench in the Southern District of New York, but I had already admired you, because my kids were going to the Park Avenue Synagogue Day School, and you had made one of your most important statements about
1984.
On terrorism. At the Park Avenue Synagogue. And
I'd gotten to know the rabbi. I'm forgetting his name now. He was a terrific person.
He was. And my kids were going to that school, the day school. I lived right nearby, near the synagogue, on the east side of New York. And, of course, everyone was concerned about terrorism. We were already subjected to a number of different types of attacks. The business had started in Lebanon with the attacks on our embassy and the Marine barracks. And you said some very important things in that speech that I think have really come back to as a guide for a national policy today.
I remember I said that we had to be ready to use force, and we had to find a regime under which that would happen and understand the intelligence aspects of that regime and do it in such a way that we had support at home in particular, and abroad. And then the piece that got quoted a lot, we can't allow ourselves to be the Hamlet of nations.
That was it.
Debating endlessly whether or not to act.
The Hamlet stuff was important, but the context of the Hamlet stuff was that we cannot sit on our hands and not fail to act preemptively. Basically, you call for what you called an active defense.
Absolutely. It's still true today. But I have another recollection of how we got together. And I had all these recommendations of this man, Abe Sofier, that would be great for the job of legal advisor to the Secretary of State. But he's a judge. And I said, my God, how do I deal with a judge? We have these co-equal branches of government. Is it unethical for me to talk to a judge? And people said, no, it's okay. And so I think I went up to New York. I was there.
And you were there to give a speech at a dinner in honor of...
I told you that I wanted to have a first-class lawyer, but that was not all I wanted out of my legal advisor. I wanted somebody who would become part of the work of the department and understand it, and would be willing to undertake missions. And that, it turned out, appealed to you. You didn't want to just be a lawyer that says you can't do this and you can't do that.
Right.
But you'd do that, but then you'd like to be part of it. And you wound up, you negotiated that Taba agreement between Israel and Egypt, was one of the only things negotiated and done and finished.
Five years.
It takes forever, but it got done. So you did it. It was good work.
It was a pleasure to do the negotiations. You did give me a chance to do that. I was so impressed with the concept of active defense at the time, before I even knew you, that I called Bud Cohen, who was my wife's uncle, married my wife's aunt, Marion's aunt, and Bud was a labor lawyer, and he told me You don't have to worry about Schultz. He's not an anti-Israel, Middle East, Arab, pro-Arab character. He's a fair-minded man. I've sat with him on labor arbitration. So Bud apparently had been exposed to you from your labor days. And he was praising you. And so when your call came, I was totally interested, very interested in what you had to say. And I recall it, we agreed at that very meeting that you would offer me the job, and I accepted.
And I'm saying to myself, what am I doing? Is it appropriate for somebody from the executive branch to be trying to recruit a judge?
Right.
So anyway, it worked out very well.
Well, it happens quite a bit. It happens
but
quite a bit.
But here we are, Abe. We're right where we were in 1984.
Yes.
Debating this issue of the preemptive use of force.
That's why I thought it was so significant.
You can see how necessary it is to be able to do that and how uneasy the concept is for people. And we see how dependent we are on intelligence, that we really have to beef up our intelligence and we have to really know what we're doing. Although the number of surprises of what are considered to be first-class intelligence groups like the Israeli intelligence, Russian intelligence, British intelligence, French, they all get surprised. And so you just know it's hard work. But anyway, you see that and you see all of the things you have to surround the preventive use of force with for it to work. But it's got to be there in this age of where terrorists can do things that kill large numbers of people. And you don't even need to have a weapon of mass destruction, as we've seen. All you need to do is commandeer an airplane and fly it into a building and you create devastation.
Absolutely. I mean, if someone shot down one of our civilian aircrafts as it was rising from an airport, just think of the losses that we would suffer in our economy.
So this whole issue of terrorism has become elevated, and we understand it a lot better. I can't say that I understood where it was coming from then, although you put the pieces together now and you look back and you see the Israeli athletes assassinated in Munich in the Olympics. You see President Sadat assassinated. Why was he assassinated? Because he made peace with Israel. Mm-hmm. So that's tied in. And the taking of American hostages in Tehran was tied in, and the bombing of our embassy and our Marine barracks.
Yeah, what we regard
all these embassies and the USS Cole, and so we went through all that period. And what did we do about it? Nothing.
Nothing
of any consequence.
But
we talked about.
Don't
it,
you
we
agree?
Were concerned, but we didn't do anything.
Don't you agree, though, that that shows that while intelligence is very important in some situations when you're considering using preventive force. In some other situations, we have a perfectly good knowledge of who our enemy is, that he has attacked us, that he plans to attack us again. And I think that before 9/11, we had a pretty solid sense that bin Laden was the enemy, that he was in Afghanistan, that he was attacking us. And the problem that the CIA had was that they simply didn't have the tactical intelligence, they said, to identify him and kill him in particular. But then after 9/11, we found a way to go in and take out his entire operation.
But one of the reasons why we were so passive through this long quarter of a century of being attacked was that we thought this was basically a problem of law enforcement.
Right.
The idea was if somebody attacks, then you try to catch them and try them and put them in jail. And what we see is, obviously, we continue to enforce the law.
Right.
But that's not by any means sufficient. And you've got to be much more aggressive and positive in what you're doing and try to find out what they're going to do before they do it and stop them from doing it. That's the name of the game.
Yeah, if a state doesn't enforce its own criminal laws and doesn't extradite criminals to you, obviously you cannot rely on the law enforcement system. And we learned that 10 days after I joined you in the State Department with this, with the seizure of TWA 847. And for the next year, when I was serving you, we suffered one terrorist incident after another until we bombed Libya, when we had at least some respite from terrorism for a while.
Yeah, but still, what we did was bomb. And in the Clinton administration, they sent a few cruise missiles around. Yeah. That didn't impress the enemy.
No, the impression wears out very soon.
Well, and also, if all you do is attack from afar, and there's no readiness to commit troops in any meaningful way, or special forces or anything, it shows that you're really not ready to be serious about it, I think.
So do you think that, well, certainly we're more serious about using preventive force today than we were, and our policy, our national policy in the national security strategy has now adopted essentially your speech from 1984. Do you think that we really mean it? Do you think that we are going to implement this policy vigorously enough to protect the American people?
Well, it's a close question. And an awful lot depends on what happens in Iraq and whether or not it's possible to bring mm-hmm. some kind of a stable situation out. And in a way, odd way, if we do, it'll be a vindication. If we don't, it'll be very hard. Mm-hmm. But here we are with Iran. And so far as I can see, there's no question about the fact that Iran desires to get a nuclear weapon. And they're developing their enrichment capacity to do it. The French have said so flatly. And so others. And people go around saying that's unacceptable. That's a big word, unacceptable. It means you're going to do something about it.
It isn't just people, it's President Bush.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have said that, not only in this country.
Right.
So we'll see. Is it possible to get China, Russia, as well as Britain and France and the United mm-hmm. States to do things short of the use of force that show Iran that we mean business. Mm-hmm. And I think it's quite possible if we did that, we could prevail. And I think there's an additional thing that we should be working on hard, and I understand that work is going forward on it, namely the effort to construct a global regime of control of enrichment and have established places that are recognized where enrichment takes place. Mm-hmm. Let the countries that are doing it probably take the places that exist and let the countries that are doing it run it with an international presence to see that enrichment is just for peaceful purposes. And then you can say to any country that wants to have a nuclear power plant, you can get enriched uranium at a reasonable price. There's no need for you to learn how to enrich uranium yourself. And so there you get control on a world basis of the enrichment process. If you can get control of that, you've gone a long ways toward getting control of nuclear weapons.
That would be a dramatic expansion
thing
of the NPT.
But then we have to also recognize that the effort that Ronald Reagan started to lower the levels of nuclear weaponry, mm-hmm. he wanted to eliminate it, that needs to continue to go forward, because countries say, well, if you can have it, why can't we have it? And we say, well, enough is enough.
But so let me raise a hypothetical.
We have to keep reducing.
That's interesting that you say both those things, George, because if we're out there trying to pressure Iran and trying to convince India and trying to convince other people Well, India, we're not trying to convince to give up enrichment, but we are trying to convince them to bring all their plants under the treaty.
But I believe India has said that it will cooperate in an effort to get control of the enrichment process.
And are you suggesting that the United States should be prepared to respond constructively, positively, to a suggestion from countries like India, Iran, and others who might want a quid pro quo for putting their enrichment processes in a form of international control, that we should be prepared to make our commitment to the NPT more meaningful and thoroughgoing by...
Well, we have to put our enrichment process into this pot too.
That's true, but what about you when you're basically the quid pro quo in the NPT is supposed to be that we're supposed to be bringing down our the number of our weapons.
And with Ronald Reagan, we did.
Yeah.
He turned that around, and we can keep going. Mm-hmm. We still have much too much.
Well, it would be a very interesting development if Iran came forward and said, we will consider this proposal of yours, but how about you? How about you showing us that you are in good faith in the NPT and will bring down meaningfully the numbers of your weapons?
We have done it already.
Yeah, we've done it already.
So we can do some more.
Well, it would certainly be an interesting negotiation.
It'll tax you. If they put you on it, you'd spend the rest of your life.
Well, it's a great way to spend your life, as you know, helping this country and the world.
Anyway, I think that this kind of thing ought to be part of the process. And the Russians made an interesting proposal to Iran. They had a version of it. They said, we will enrich the uranium for the nuclear power plant that you have, and therefore you don't need to do it. So don't reopen your plant. And we will do this, we guarantee. And the Iranians rejected that.
Well, my sense of the Iranians is that they need to save face all the time. And even when they don't need to save face, they'll tell you they need to save face.
Yes, so. But they'll tell you the only way we can save face is to you lose it.
Right. I think that they would feel if they were to demand a major reduction in the nuclear weapons in the West as a quid pro quo for going under an enrichment program, that they would have achieved something meaningful. I think they might feel that way. So I think your idea has some real potential.
Well, I would like to see the initiative with us, not with them.
Certainly, it's great to have us putting forward that initiative, but as you know, many years have passed since Ronald Reagan made that proposal. And since you left office, there has not been very meaningful reductions in the number of nuclear weapons out there.
President Reagan was a very moral man. And he thought nuclear weapons were immoral, that any weapon that could be that destructive just didn't belong on Earth. That's what he thought.
That's right, but as you recall, he put on the table the proposition that he would develop a missile defense system for the world, not just for America, and that he would allow the internationalization, essentially, of that missile defense system, or at least the Soviet Union, to share it with us, so that other countries...
I remember that exchange at Reykjavik. And Gorbachev looked at him and he said, Mr. President, you wouldn't even sell us milk technology. But things could have moved on.
Yeah, well, I think that the Iranians would certainly have that question for us.
Well, they'd have any question they think could stall things along. They're playing, and we have to recognize time is not on our hand, on our side.
Yeah. Well, I think if they understand that we are going to act, certainly the context of the negotiation would change.
Well, you have to have, if you're going to have successful diplomacy, you have to have some force. You have to have some, not necessarily military force, but you have to have something that allows you to be taken seriously. I say, strength without diplomacy is a wasting asset. Mm-hmm. Diplomacy without strength is a waste of time. And the Iranians right now are convinced that they can do anything they want and there's no consequence, adverse consequence to them. So they got to see that they can do things that will cause, on a world scale, a consequence. Otherwise, they won't pay any attention. But anyway, this is sort of strength and diplomacy go together. And it's been a watchword of our country since the beginning.
Well, it isn't just Iran. You know, when we raise this issue of, are we really serious about defending America with preventive force? We now, because I'm in the law side of things, I was your guy in implementing a lot of policies across the board on terrorism. And one of the policies that we advocated, which now finally is the law of the world, it was that if a state failed to prevent terrorism from within its borders, the terrorist acts that emanated from that state created a right of self-defense.
Yes, that's in the UN Security Council resolution.
Right. And this was adopted after 9/11, but in connection with Afghanistan. But it takes the form of a legislative enactment. The council resolution is really like a law, as you know. And it would certainly apply to Syria today, because Syria has many terrorist leaders that it's given.
Furthermore, it is, have you read the document of this German prosecutor, I guess, or lawyer,
concerning
that investigated the murder of Harari, the former president of Lebanon?
Yes, I have.
And so now we see the Syrian regime exposed as mafia-style murderers.
And the statement of the former foreign minister.
Amazing thing is that they leave so many fingerprints on it.
Right.
It wasn't even difficult to find that out.
Well, he was a man who was in the meeting. The foreign minister was in the meeting with Assad when Assad threatened Hariri with death.
And so now he's living in Paris and
yes, indeed,
telling people what's what.
Well, we do believe in asylum for people who would face that kind of a
absolutely
death, right? And on top of that, Syria is helping essentially terrorists, people who are killing innocent Iraqis in Iraq. They've allowed infiltration.
And Syria is an avenue through which Iran finances Hezbollah in Lebanon. And I guess they're not a conduit to Hamas, but anyway, they would if they could.
So we have a situation where for years now we've been warning Syria, threatening Syria.
And we haven't done anything about it.
Anything at all.
That's what the problem is.
We've thoroughly alienated Syria, but I don't think this...
Well, Syria deserves to be alienated. Come on. Don't blame us. Blame them.
Well, sir, Frank Wisner, who you love and admire, said, you need to deal with Syria, and you need to deal with them face-to-face and in a diplomatically effective way. And the sort of arm's-length treatment of Syria certainly does not lead to anything constructive. If we're not going to use force against Syria, we at least should be diplomatically effective in dealing with Syria. And I have seen no evidence, neither has Frank, and Frank's commentary is more important than mine in this regard, because Frank is an expert on the Middle East, and he thought that we should be engaging Syria in a more constructive way.
Well, I think we should be there, but we should tell Syria what we think about their behavior.
Right. Well, it goes back to what you said about force and diplomacy.
Maybe, you know, the great seal of our country has as its centerpiece an eagle. Probably there's one around here somewhere. There it is. And in one talon, the eagle is holding an olive branch to show that the United States will always seek peace, and the eagle is looking at the olive branch. And in the other talon, the eagle's holding on to arrows, 13, that shows how long this has been around.
Right.
And the whole point is strength and diplomacy go together if you want to achieve peace.
I did get the feeling that the reason we don't talk to people, some states sometimes, is because we really do not mean to use force against them. And so we almost know in advance that our diplomacy is going to be ineffective. If we were willing to use force with the Taliban, with Syria, I think we would be more willing to talk to these countries and more effective in doing so. That's really the implication of what you're saying.
Well, it would be good to be able to organize things short of force that nevertheless
of course
have an impact.
Well, that's what happens. You sometimes can avoid, many times can avoid using force because you have the willingness to do it, as you said.
But it's hard to do. Economic sanctions basically don't work very well, certainly over a period of time.
Right.
Everybody
you called it light switch diplomacy once.
Well, that referred to the idea that you could turn it on and off like a light switch.
Right.
Which I think is ridiculous.
So when you leave a country, you stop talking to them, you better realize that it's going to take you many, many years to reconstruct what you had to get back to where you were.
I always thought it's wrong. The instinct that people have when something happens they don't like, they say, we're recalling our ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
That's not smart. You want your ambassador to be there. And that's the key person that is received and who can look around and see things and communicate your point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a step that people take all the time, but would be better off to leave the ambassador there.
Well, one of the most dramatic things I recall you doing in the State Department was opening the door to the PLO. And I was there the day you did that, and I was there and helped implement your decision that made that happen when you refused Arafat a visa to the UN. And I knew before you refused Arafat that visa that you were more motivated to open that door and to let diplomacy happen than you were to shut that door completely.
Well, we had the prohibition in the law,
right,
against terrorists coming to this country. And the law said that if somebody applied that was suspected of being a terrorist,
mm-hmm,
first the Secretary of State had to make a recommendation to the Attorney General that the Attorney General consider allowing that person to come in. So the Attorney General doesn't get a crack at it unless the Secretary of State makes a recommendation, which I couldn't do with respect to Arafat because he had been involved in terrorist operations, including recently. So we said no.
But that was
and
the first time.
Oh yeah, and oh, did I catch hell for that. But Ronald Reagan supported me. That was the big deal.
Right.
So then they moved the whole UN process to Geneva so Arafat could take part.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big turmoil about that. But then Arafat started making more positive noises about the things that we wanted him to say. And the Swedish foreign minister sought to mediate. And he got Arafat to write out a statement to him. I said, that's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Then Arafat said various things. And President Reagan wanted to know, well, what about it? And I said, well, Mr. President, at one phrase he said, unk, unk, unk. And another place he said, cool, cool, cool. But no place did he say uncle. So he's got to come clean. And finally he did recognize, went on television, recognized Israel's right to exist, recognized 242 as a basis for negotiation, and renounced terrorism. Now, the mistake we made with Arafat was when he reverted to violence, we didn't stop. And even after Oslo, I thought one of the reasons Oslo didn't succeed was that we let him get away with the use of violence. And if right off the bat, the first thing you've got to stop, and people are so anxious to see
the progress
succeed that they didn't want to rock the boat.
It was
something I learned long ago in my labor relations days. After World War II, there were lots of strikes, and people were writing all the time about why this strike and that strike. And some people got together and they said, we should recognize there are a lot of places where people work out their problems peacefully. So let's have some studies of the causes of industrial peace under collective bargaining. And as a young assistant professor at MIT, I wrote three of those studies. And then I sort of kept track of what was going on, and I found that there were some where the relationship deteriorated. So I looked into it, and why did it deteriorate? And the reason was always the same. People became enchanted with the relationship. And if somebody on the shop floor had a grievance and wanted to push it, the shop steward would say, look, cool it. We got a great relationship going here. Don't rock the boat. And if a foreman wanted to discipline somebody, the manager would say, cool it. We've got a great relationship here. Don't rock the boat. So pretty soon, the relationship that's so great is not serving the interests of the people to it. And after a while, that builds up and it explodes. So I've always felt that obviously you want to have reasonable relations with people, and that's valuable, but it's a huge mistake to put the relationship on some sort of a plane. In the Oslo process, they did exactly that. They said, here's this process, it's working, it's producing good results, and so we don't want to disturb it by stopping when something goes wrong and saying, no, we're not going, this is wrong, you got to stop this violence. Not use the violence as a way to get some extra concession. So people, oh, well, you'll stop the violence if we do this. That only encourages more. So I think the way it was handled was mistaken in that sense.
Well, that's a very consistent observation with your policy regarding the PLO, because when you did call a halt to the dance that we were engaging in with the PLO, allowing them to come here even though they were terrorists, they moved forward. And
said uncle.
Finally. Yeah, they finally, at least there was a progress.
We had the same thing happen.
It took real turmoil to make that happen.
We had the same thing in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Here we had the African National Congress, the ANC, and people were worried that they had engaged in some terrorism and they had some affiliations with the Soviet Union. And so they were kept at arm's length. And the head of the ANC came to the United States and asked to see me. So naturally, I checked that over carefully with Ronald Reagan. I said, we may not like everything these people do, but they do represent the blacks in South Africa. And we don't want to get ourselves in a position where we can't talk to them. So I should receive him and tell him exactly what we think about their communist ties and their terrorism. It's not whether you meet somebody, it's what you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And so he authorized that meeting, and it was very controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Some people called for my resignation for being willing to meet him. But it was an important thing that we keep our line open to the people who represented the black population of South Africa. And it was interesting to me, from time to time I see somebody from South Africa, maybe a prominent black businessman or something, they're all members of the ANC, and almost without fail they come and they tell me what an important thing it was that I received Oliver Tambo, and how it moderated them, it gave them a different view of the United States, and so on. So you've got to deal with people.
It also led them to move away from terrorist actions and communist ideology.
Right. Pretty soon they were in telling us anti-communist jokes. That's what Ronald Reagan always liked.
Indeed. Well, that's it's sort of engage. It says what you're saying indicates to me. It says engage, take everything seriously, take your own commitment seriously, and mean what you say when you say you're going to use force if things become a threat to the United States.
But don't be afraid to say the reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's ironic, George, that the whole process of diplomatic engagement has these double-edged qualities, that those who seem to be prepared to go beyond talk are often the most effective at bringing about peace through talk.
Right. Peace through strength. That was Ronald Reagan's motto. Realism, we said our policy is realism, strength, diplomacy. Very simple.
Well, you've got a conference coming up on Reykjavik in October this year. I look forward to it. And then we have our own Preventive Force Conference in November. And so this process is going on as far as you're concerned.
Yes, well, these are big, important issues, and you got to keep working at them. So I'll keep working.
It'll be very interesting to see the consequences. Maybe we can meet again and chat about what happened after our Reykjavik conference.
Maybe.
Be a pleasure, sir.
Okay.